few words in human language bring up more fear, more terror than the word cancer. In this very important interview discussion, we are going to be given the distinct honor and pleasure of speaking with Dr. Jason Fung, who has a new book out called The Cancer Code. You may have heard of Dr. Fung in the past. He's written such great books as The Complete Guide to Fasting, The Diabetes Code, and The Obesity Code. And I think all of these books are great. I've read them all, and I just finished The Cancer Code. I listened to it on Audible. It is available on Audible. So for people, if you're like me and you have a touch of ADD and you can't just sit and read a book, then it's available on Audible. Dr. Fung's going to be joining us here in just a few minutes, and I'm really excited to pick his brain about cancer. You may or may not know that one of our previous presidents, Richard Nixon, signed a bill into law and basically declared war on cancer back in 1971. It was way before my time, but he did that. I read it on Wikipedia. And since then, we have had a few small victories here and there, but no huge victories. We've won a few minor battles, but in no way are we anywhere close to winning the war on cancer. It's estimated that the United States government and the Canadian government, along with the American Cancer Society, have spent well over $200 million since 1971. Trying to cure cancer, trying to win this war on cancer. And we've done a terrible job. And I think, and I think Dr. Fung thinks as well, is because we had a complete wrong paradigm about cancer, about what it was, what caused it. I see Dr. Fung's joined us here. I'm going to bring him up in just a second. But if you have a family member who has cancer, had cancer in the past, has a family history of cancer, then I think that there are a few things you could do that would potentially help them more than sharing this video. So if nothing more, they could get the link in the show notes for Dr. Fung's new book, The Cancer Code, and start to think about how we think about cancer. Now, let me bring up the good doctor here. Let's see if our, oh, wait, I don't want you to be, hello, doctor.
Hey.
Hey, doc, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too.
Absolutely. So I gave a little brief introduction. Now, this is Dr. Jason Fung. If you don't know him, you've been hiding under a rock. He is board certified in nephrology. I think you got your medical school degree from the University of Toronto and then did your residency in nephrology at UCLA. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. And so you guys may or may not know. So a nephrologist is a kidney specialist. But in med school, we referred to nephrologists as a nerd's nerd, which in medical school is a very high compliment because you're pretty much a nerd to get to medical school. And then if you're gonna do a residency in nephrology, you are a nerd's nerd, and kudos sure to you. And that's an absolute compliment, no way negative. Doctor, I gave a brief little introduction. Today I want to talk about your new book, not so much about the book, but about the concepts and the paradigm in that book, because I think that it's literally going to be a watershed for the way we think about cancer, the way we start to hopefully research cancer, and then also how people can just start to think about cancer differently. Because if you're using a wrong paradigm, you think, oh, well, the sun, you know, orbits around the earth. Well, that limits you in not just that one mistake you've made, but it limits you in hundreds of ways. It limits the way you think about solutions. It limits the way you think about even the problem itself. And so I think that your book, and I know you're standing on the shoulders of other giants, just like we all are, but your book, I think, culminates this paradigm change in the way we think about what is cancer, what causes cancer, where does it come from, why is it so damn hard to beat? And so jump in and let's just take this wherever you want to go, because you are the man with the plan.
Thanks so much. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that knowing the paradigm really has a huge impact on research and treatment, which is why this is so important. And, you know, I'm just trying to explain it to, you know, a lot of this research, of course, is not done by me because I'm not an oncologist, but I got so fascinated as I was reading this, and it was so new and different, and you know, and maybe a few sort of top oncologists know this sort of new evolutionary paradigm of cancer, but most people have never heard of it. Like, most doctors hadn't heard of it. I hadn't really heard of it. I'm sure most of the people hadn't heard of it. And this is what was so fascinating about it. But we've already sort of moved on. So just to back up, you know, so what I describe in the book is sort of how we have gone through sort of three major paradigm shifts in the way we think about cancer. And the reason that's important is that the cancer, you have to understand what causes it in order to, you know, understand how to treat it. That is, if you know that, you know, an infection is caused by a bacteria, you can get antibiotics. But if you don't know that, then you're just sort of tumbling around in the dark for something effective. Cancer is this very, very mysterious and interesting disease because it's basically unlike anything we have ever dealt with, but it's very common. So it's not some rare thing that happens to sort of one or two people in the United States. It's the second biggest killer of Americans. So here's this disease that is everywhere practically. It's like more important than just about every other disease other than heart disease, because it's the number two killer of Americans right after heart disease. And that's actually neck and neck. And yet we don't even know what it is. And like, why does this thing called cancer even develop? Like, it's very strange, because lung cancer, for example, is derived from our own, you know, lung cell that was healthy before and suddenly turned into this sort of rogue, you know, cell and grew and metastasized and killed us. And it's a very strange thing, because why would it happen? Like, it doesn't make any sense. This is why we have to sort of go back a little bit and understand it. So if you think about the sort of first great paradigm, what we thought about cancer was that this is basically just a cell that grows too much. So if you have breast cancer, you have this breast cell and it just, you know, turns into a cancer and it just grows and grows and grows. And then it moves all over the place and metastasizes. And that's what it was. So if it's a cell that grows too much, then the logical solution is to kill it, right? I mean, that's logical. It's growing. Let's kill it. So that's where we got the sort of treatments of this first paradigm, which involves surgery. So cut it out, basically. You have radiation, which is burn it. And you have chemotherapy, which is poison it. Okay, so cutting, burning, poisoning. And so these are basically ways to kill cells. And what you try to do is figure out a way to kill cells before you kill the patient. So, you know, surgery, you try and do sort of sparing surgery, chemotherapy, for example, you try to target those cells that are cancerous while sparing the regular cells. But the problem, of course, is that there's tons of side effects because these are poisons. So you get your people's hair falling out and you get the nausea that's sort of typical with of all this sort of thing. And it's not to say that that was an important paradigm, because most of modern oncology is still based on these treatments. So I'm not trying to be negative about it, but we started to reach our limits. So yeah, we can look for better ways to kill cells, but it doesn't tell you anything about the paradigm itself. That is, the paradigm itself is lacking, because you don't know what is causing these cells to grow. So we know they're growing, but why? So you have to ask the question why. And that was the sort of second great advance of cancer, so what I call cancer paradigm 2.0. So instead of saying that these cells are just growing, we say, why are they growing? And in the 60s and 70s, we started to discover that, well, you know, cells have genes, and when genes get mutated, then they might grow too much. So this was a way to sort of tie everything together. So we knew we had a bunch of things such as smoking and, you know, asbestos and radiation and certain viruses like human papillomaviruses. We had these different things that cause cancer. And we said, well, these things cause genetic mutations. and therefore they cause excessive growth. So this was, you know, a very important change in the way that we looked at the problem of cancer. The problem wasn't just that they're growing, the problem was the genetic mutations. And this is what sort of dominated cancer medicine from the 70s to probably the 2010s. So this is what I learned in medical school, the two-hit hypothesis, and, you know, it's somatic mutation theory. It's all about genetic mutations. When you smoke, for example, it's not a targeted mutation. Like, you're not targeting a specific gene the way you can now with CRISPR and some of these other very fancy things. It's basically saying that, well, when you have tobacco smoke, you're sustaining damage to the genes, and by chance, you might hit a critical gene and then you turn into cancer. So essentially just like saying, well, if you want to win the lottery, buy more lottery tickets, right? So the more chances you have to win. Same thing with smoking, for example. You smoke a lot, you're getting more damage, more chances to turn into cancer. And then once that cell turns cancerous, it would then propagate and then become cancer. So the first few treatments, again, so now we switch. Now we have a totally new paradigm. And this is the same paradigm. You could go today to the American Cancer Society. They're still talking about genetic mutations. And the thing is that when you're looking at treatments, now you can say, well, let's not focus on killing cells. Let's focus on finding ways to fix these genes, right? So a totally new paradigm. And then what you say is that, well, the first few treatments, so we developed this one called imatinib, which is also called Gleevec, which is for a type of leukemia called CML. Very rare cancer, but unbelievably good. Like, the treatment just sort of revolutionized the treatment of CML. It went from a disease that was pretty bad to a disease that was just about cured. It was ridiculously good. And then we had trastuzumab, which is Herceptin, which was used for breast cancer. So there's this gene called HER2NU, and we developed a way to block this gene. So again, not trying to kill cells, you're trying to fix genetic problems. And what was even more incredible was that they figured that, hey, and not everybody has this mutation. So they said, well, let's look for this mutation and just give it to those people that have it. Again, fantastic, completely mind-blowingly good, because now you're going to spare the 90% of people without that gene from the cost and the side effects of this drug. So what we're talking about was not only targeted therapeutics, it was going to be personalized, right? So this was a whole game changer, personalized targeted medicine for cancer. So this is in the 90s and 2000s. And honestly, we thought we were going to cure cancer within 10 years. Like, that was it. We would bring all this technology. So we launched the Human Genome Project, which, if you remember, was this massive sort of multinational thing to sequence the genes of one entire human being.
Yep.
Took about $100 million and finished in 2000. And we said, well, that's going to be the roadmap. We're going to find all the genes we need for cancer. That's going to be it. We're going to have two or three mutations for breast cancer, two or three mutations in colon cancer. We'll figure out those, and then we'll just treat them, right? So that was sort of where we were in 2000. But unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. So what happened after that was that instead of finding two or three gene mutations in one cancer, like colon cancer, it wasn't like two or three, it was like 100 different mutations. And the problem, of course, is that you can't go and develop 100 different drugs for this one problem. There's a bigger problem, because if you look at colon cancer, there was an incredible variety. So patient A with colon cancer would have 100 mutations. Patient B would have 100 mutations, but completely separate from the from patient A. And even within patient A, the tumor, even within that very same tumor, had different gene mutations. There's mutations like everywhere. And the last count in 2018, when they looked at, hey, how many mutations have we found in cancer, is about 6 million. So 6 million different mutations, right, in cancer. And it's like, well, okay, well, that is not going to work. And that's where, you know, you started out talking about why we've made so little progress in cancers, because the paradigm is not one that lends itself to a treatment. So the number after those first two sort of incredible sort of successes, I mean, the number of treatments from a genetic treatments that have been effective have been like what? You could probably count them on one hand, honestly. It's been very little. So that's why if you look at cancer versus heart disease, in the last 50 years, heart disease went from being twice as likely to kill you to basically the same. And this is, you know, and that's where we were in 2010. The whole thing was basically shut down. We weren't making any progress in this genetic thing. And that's sort of what was the next step to this third great sort of change in paradigm, which is, again, not trying to invalidate the previous paradigms, but trying to ask the question, why? Because the when you say there's genetic mutations, there's a lot of genetic mutations, but the question is, why are they developing? The somatic mutation theory, which was the genetic sort of paradigm, said they were sort of random, but they were not random because cancer is a very, very specific sort of, it looks very much the same. That is, you know, there are certain characteristics of cancer. It grows too much. They have immortality, like immortal cells. They metastasize where normal cells don't. And they use this funny sort of glycolysis, which normal cells do not use. So there's very specific sort of strange portfolio of cancer that is shared amongst all cancers. So there's not anything random about it. And what it turns out to be, which is a very strange sort of answer that we never anticipated, was that this was an evolutionary process against sort of chronic damage, chronic sublethal damage. So things like viruses and smoke and radiation, when you give it chronically, that acts as a selection pressure to develop these types of mutation. And why that's important is that it leads you to a whole different way. So cancer, you can think of almost as a transformation into a sort of almost a foreign invasive species.
Yep.
You might think, okay, well, that's bizarre, right? How can breast cancer be a foreign invasive species? It's like, well, you know, it's not me that looks at it that way. It's your own body. So our body has an immune system. And the immune system has to differentiate between our own cells and foreign cells, right? There's self and non-self. And when our immune system actually sees a cancer, it is identified as a foreign cell. It will attack it immediately without ever having seen it before. So yep. It's not me saying that it's a foreign species. It's your own body has identified it as a foreign species, which is fascinating because now you can bring in this whole new sort of evolutionary biology, all the tools we've developed in evolutionary biology, and apply them to cancer therapeutics, which gives you, like, we have a system to deal with foreign invasive species, our immune system. So what happens is that you can now boost the immune system and attack these cancers by using our body's own sort of immune system. And that leads to this whole new treatment paradigm, which is, let's not focus on killing cells. That's paradigm one. Let's not focus on changing genes. That's paradigm two. Let's focus on immunotherapy, boosting the immune system, because these are foreign invasive species. And it's fantastic because now you've sort of opened up this whole new window and opportunity. There's other things you can do. And I point out a few other things like the abscopal effect and adaptive therapy, which are new ways of attacking cancer, which you would not be able to understand unless you understood the evolutionary paradigm of cancer. And that's, you know, why I'm sort of optimistic that, hey, maybe we will make some progress in the future because we've answered a very, very thorny problem as to what is cancer and what causes cancer. And that's why it's important. And the other reason it's important is because when you talk about evolution depends on two things. It's not just the seed, it's the seed and the soil. That is, when we talk about purely genetics is all about the seed and gives you this sort of, you know, fatalistic, well, I can't change my genes, you can't change your genes, so it's just bad luck. But it's not, because if you have a seed of cancer which exists in all of us but it's planted in inhospitable soil, it will still not grow. And therefore, if you can change that soil, which we have the ability to do, then even with the seed, we can still stop cancer in its tracks. And the soil, of course, is our diet and lifestyle. And that's what's important. So I spend the second half of the book talking about sort of how nutrition and cancer sort of intersect and what we can do about it to sort of bring down our rates. Because again, if you look at, you know, traditional societies like the Inuit in the far north, in the 20s and 30s, universities were actually sending expeditions to the Arctic Circle to find out why the Inuit were immune to cancer. Once they changed their lifestyle to be more like, you know, the Canadians, cancer just went right up. So they weren't immune after all. It was that their lifestyle prevented these cancers from developing. Same thing in the Africans. So interestingly, Dennis Burkitt, who described the Burkitt lymphoma, when he went to Africa in the 60s and 50s, he basically looked at the Africans following a traditional diet and said, they just don't get colon cancer, like ever. But as soon as those Africans start eating the same diet as the white folks, then you started to see the cancer. So he called it one of the diseases of civilization, which again tells you it's not just the seed, it's about the seed and the soil. So while you can't do anything about the cancerous seed, you can do something about the soil, and that's why it's important.
Yeah, I totally agree. And one of the things that blew me away about your book is that, you know, so there are prokaryotic cells like bacteria that are, it's basically every man for himself. I'm going to, and these cells can divide and duplicate themselves. They don't have a community, really. Sometimes they'll get behind a slime wall that they all mutually build, but there's no real cooperation in prokaryotic cells. And so every eukaryotic cell in our body really evolved from prokaryotic cells in the past. And so it's not that the cancer is something new. It's actually something very ancient that probably every cell in our body has the potential. And so if you could think of cells as citizens in a society. So back in the wild, you know, 100,000 years ago, it was every man for himself. If you were outside of a tribe, if you were just a loner, you killed who you had to kill. You ate what you had to eat. You reproduced as much as you could. You didn't give a damn what society thought. You didn't care about the police. You didn't care about any of that. And some people still are like that today, right, Doc? And as we developed into these eukaryotic multicellular organisms, there had to be rules. Just like if you live in Toronto or New York or Nashville, there's rules. You cannot cross the street except at a crosswalk. You cannot just build a new business in the middle of the street. You can't. There are all these things you can't do, and those rules are there so that society is orderly. And so basically what I got from your book, and tell me if I misspeak, is that cancer probably is the unshackling of our eukaryotic cells, basically one or more of our eukaryotic cells that were previously following the law, being good citizens in the eukaryotic organism, said to hell with it. I'm done with this. For whatever reason, that cell just said, screw it. I'm going to just shoot who I want to shoot, eat what I want to eat. I'm going to reproduce at will. I'm just going to crap right here in the middle of the street. I don't care who says anything. And then I'll just move across town if the cops start chasing me. And I, you know, and so it's like the very civil eukaryotic cells have thrown off the shackles of being socialized, of being social cells, and they've reverted back to their prokaryotic ability to multiply, because the average eukaryotic cell in your skin or in your liver or your colon, they can't do that. We have stem cells that produce new cells, and then they differentiate into the cell they're supposed to be. They live their nice little upstanding citizen life. They do their job. And then when they get old enough that they're not productive anymore, they go through this process called apoptosis, where they basically willingly commit suicide so that a new healthy cell can take their place. Well, cancer cells say, to hell with all that. I'm not doing any of that. I'm going to just do what I want to do. And that, I think that paradigm is so powerful to understand. This is not a, it's not a new thing. It's actually a very ancient thing, even primordial, for cells to throw off these shackles and just say, screw it, I'm going to do what I want to do.
And that's what's so mind-blowing about this sort of paradigm is that it actually explains so much. So essentially the cells, you know, our cells live together in a well-functioning society. And it has a huge advantage compared to a single-celled organism because a single-celled organism is only one cell. So basically, if you want to think about the man, the survivalist in the woods, I call him, you know, he has to do everything himself. He has to cook his own food, find his own food, cook his own food, make his own clothes, everything. When you move to a society of cells, so when you get cells all working together, it's just like when you have people working together. So you have people who specialize in tax audits, for example. So you wouldn't survive in the wild if all you could do is tax audits, right? But you come and you live in New York and you do very well doing tax audits all day long. So it's the same thing, you can specialize. So our cells have specialized. So the liver cell only does liver stuff and the lung cell only does lung stuff. You don't do everything yourself. And that's how you gain an advantage. So when you band together, just like cities, you do better than everybody working separately. However, when you have that breakdown of law and order, when you have that breakdown of those rules that cooperate, then all these cells go back to being survivalist. So it's just like if you have, you know, for example, some of these movies where you have zombies taking over the city or something like that, right? Everybody, law and order breaks down, then people start looting and shooting each other. Why? Because they're trying to survive. Right, they've turned from a normal cell and a, you know, normal person in a well-functioning society. All your rules break down, and all of a sudden you get warlords, you get shooting and looting and all this stuff because that's what you do to survive. And that's the same process that has happened in the cell. You've gone from a cell that's all working nicely together to a cell that's just doing whatever it can to survive. And it reverts to, it evolves not forward, but evolves backwards to a more ancient past. And why that's you know, so powerful is because it explains a lot of what was missing in cancer. Because if we just thought of it as random mutations, you'd say, well, if you have random mutations, why does patient A's colon cancer look exactly like patient B's colon cancer? Because they evolved completely independently. So if they're going forward with new evolutions, well, they would, should look completely different. But if they're evolving backwards to a more primordial ancestor, then they're all going to look the same. Explains perfectly why that should happen. Explains perfectly why every cell in our body can become cancer. You get cancers of your eyeball, cancers of your heart, cancers of your placenta. Like, it's crazy. Why should every cell in your body? But it goes way back beyond humanity. Practically every living organism, like multicellular organism, can have cancer. So even in Hydra, which is this really primitive, so, you know, microscopic little animal, it gets cancer. And it's like, wow, why is that the case? It's because that cancer seed is actually not something that's foreign. It's something that's actually part of every one of our cells. And it's a mind-blowing sort of revelation how that can happen. Like, just like cancer, how do you get 100 mutations in one cell and it hasn't died yet, right? How does that happen? Because, you know, a well-functioning cell is like a fine watch, right? Everything has its place and everything moves. You whack it with a hammer, it doesn't usually work better, right? Right. It usually works much worse, okay? So when you have a mutation to a cell, it's usually fatal. Like, those cells usually die. So how can you have 100 mutations that don't kill the cell? They should all die. So cancer should be an incredibly rare event, but it's not. It's super, super, super common. Like, prostate cancer is going to affect by age 90, like half the men on earth that are still living will have prostate cancer, microscopic, but they still have it. Breast cancer, super common, right? It should be sort of 1 in 10 million people it should get cancer if you're trying to put together, you know, stitch together 100 mutations, 100 random mutations that don't kill the cell. So this is the thing that's you know, so mind-blowing about this new paradigm is that it actually explains almost everything about how cancer behaves. And things like, you know, look at, you know, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. Well, you know that we use radiation and chemotherapy to cure cancer, and you know that all of those are actually carcinogens. So radiation is a carcinogen.
Yep.
cancer medicines, the very medicines that you use to treat cancer, will cause cancer.
Absolutely.
Why is that? Why? Because it's a poison, right? It's a chronic sublethal injury. So again, and not only that, but you say, okay, like what you need is a chronic sublethal injury. Why, you know, why does it have to be sublethal? Well, if you have an overwhelming injury, then everything just dies and they can't become cancerous. And it has to be chronic because that's how evolution works. You need a chronic selection pressure. So you look at a virus, for example, hepatitis B, hepatitis C. Those are viruses that cause liver cancer because they cause chronic liver damage. Hepatitis A and hepatitis E, which cause fulminant hepatic failure, that is acute severe liver damage, but not chronic, they don't cause cancer. That explains it perfectly. Why does H. pylori cause cancer? Because it's a chronic sort of very chronic sort of gastritis. It's chronic and it's sublethal. Radiation is the same. So it's incredibly powerful sort of paradigm to explain what is happening to our cells. And the more you can understand it, of course, the better you can target it. So for example, chemotherapy, there's this move towards adaptive therapy or this, so adaptive therapy is where you don't, so when you treat people with chemotherapy, you generally use something called maximally tolerated dose, MDT or MTD, which is basically give as much chemotherapy as you can without killing the patient. But if you look at it from an evolutionary perspective, you say, well, if you do that, you're just going to create resistance. And guess what? That's exactly what you get. And in fact, if you look at the way that cancer behaves and the way that infections behave, they're exactly the same. Why? Because cancer is like an invasive species. So if you look at cancer and infections, they both metastasize, right? You get metastatic infections. So if you have an infection in your blood, like if say you have an infection that came from your kidney, it will metastasize into the blood and move to your heart valve or something. It can certainly do that, or to your lung or whatever. And so can cancer, but not anything else. Like gallstones don't metastasize, you know, right. Or a cut on your toe doesn't metastasize into a cut on your eyebrow. Like that's ridiculous. But both of those do the same thing. How about resistance? Well, you get resistance in antibiotics and you get resistance in terms of cancer. So when you treat a cancer with a drug, it will eventually develop resistance. So you treat prostate cancer with, say, hormonal deprivation. But it will now change into a cancer that resists that hormonal deprivation, just like an infection will.
Yeah.
This is incredible, because now you can take all your lessons from infectious disease and say, well, cancer is also an invasive species. Let's treat it like that. Maybe you don't need to kill every single one of those bacteria. Maybe you don't use maximally tolerated therapy, right? Maybe you just give enough to keep it under suppression, which is called adaptive therapy. And this is not necessarily going to cure everything, but it's a way that these new paradigms lead to new ways of looking at treatment that might be a significant advance. So for example, prostate cancer. If you just say, okay, this is a prostate cancer is just gene mutations. As soon as I find a prostate cancer cell, one, I'm whacking out that prostate, right? And we used to do that. We used to take out tons of prostates and all kinds of. Now you say, well, what we know is that there's a prostate cancer. That means there's an invasive species in that prostate, but it's being held in check by our own immune system because we know it's slow growing in general, right? Maybe we don't need to treat it. Maybe our better is to use watch and wait. And guess what? That's exactly what we found. In lots of low-grade cancers, you do more harm by going in there and trying to whack everything out. Breast cancer is the same thing. Breast cancer is a ridiculously important topic. And what we're doing now is that we're finding all these very, very, very early breast cancers. And we go in there with chemotherapy with the idea that, hey, the sooner we whack it out, the better. Not realizing that, hey, it's just like if you have one bacteria, you don't go and whack it out because you can get resistance to it. You might do more harm than good. Like we know there's tons of, in our microbiome, for example, there's tons of good bacteria. You're not there to, you don't need to kill everything. Same thing with the cancer cell. Maybe you do better with watchful waiting. Now people are starting to roll back, the age to do mammograms and all this sort of stuff, which again, you could never understand if you didn't understand the evolutionary paradigm of cancer. You'd say, why wouldn't you want to do mammograms at age 20, for example, right? And it's like, well, because the seed is always there. The point is you don't always have to treat
it. Prostate cancer and breast cancer are two of the cancers as a primary care physician that I've seen over my 20 years of practice that I would almost recoil in horror when one of my very elderly patients was diagnosed with prostate cancer or breast cancer, because very often watchful waiting would give them an extra 20 years of life, right? Because many breast cancers and many prostatic cancers are very, very slow growing. It might take 10, 15, 20 years to end their life. And so if someone's 80 years of age, that's, they're going to only live to 95. Well, darn, but that's pretty darn good. And they're not going to have to cope with chemotherapy and radiation therapy and all the side effects that go along with that. And so I think starting to think about cancer as an infectious disease, as not that it's caused by a bacteria or a virus, but that the removal of the constraints of a eukaryotic cell allows these cells to revert back to their prokaryotic or bacterial-like function. And so that's why the immune system starts to recognize them as foreign tissue, because they've effectively become foreign tissue. And so I think that's such a great way to think about it, because now we can actually think, well, okay, so you've got prostate cancer, you're 80 years old, I can either put you through the literal oncological ringer with radiation therapy and chemotherapy, we can take your prostate out, so you'll have lifelong urinary symptoms. Or if we know which kind of prostate cancer this is, we can just do some watchful waiting. We can maybe implement some immune therapy to kind of maximize your immune system to kind of just let it sit there. But as long as it's not growing and metastasizing, who really cares if you have prostate cancer or not? As long as you feel great, you look great, you're able to urinate great and other things, why would we want to subject you to the barbaric oncology suite treatments when that's really not necessary? It's so funny because right after I listened to your book on Audible, I listened to an amazing book called The Selfish Gene by Dawkins. I don't know if you've ever read that or not, but if you haven't, Doc, you need to read that book, because he goes into depth about the prokaryotic and the evolutionary cycle of how they'll do anything to survive. They'll do anything to reproduce. They're able to fool any immune cell. They're able to fool any antibiotic. They're able to, I mean, they literally came from the muck and ran the entire world for millennia. These guys, when you take the constraints off of our eukaryotic cells and allow them to just become anarchists, you might say, in your body, they are very, very powerful. And if we continue to use these old paradigms of, chemo, radiation, and surgery, we're going to continue to lose this war on cancer.
Absolutely. And understanding this new paradigm opens up a whole new possibility, because again, if you have sort of new, invasive species, right, then you can say, okay, well, what can I do to sort of slow its growth down? And one of the very important things that all cells sort of share is this dependence upon growth factors. And this is where nutrition starts to play such a huge role in the development of cancer, because we actually have these nutrient sensors in our body. And again, this is all sort of data that's just like, it's fairly recent and just mind-blowing in its implication. That what happens is that, we've always known about insulin, for example, and then we discovered mTOR, which is another nutrient sensor. So insulin, when you eat, insulin goes up. When you eat protein, mTOR goes up. So these are nutrient sensors, and the reason your body needs them is because, our cells need to know if nutrients are available. If nutrients, remember, we have trillions of cells in our body. So if we have food, then we can grow. If we don't have food, you don't want to grow. You want to get rid of cells, right? So if you have malnourished children, for example, they're very short. And then when you feed them properly, they grow because of these nutrient sensors. And it turns out that these nutrient sensors didn't originate as nutrient sensors. So insulin didn't start out from an evolutionary standpoint as a nutrient sensor. It was actually originally in the most primitive organisms, insulin is a growth factor. And this is that link that is, you know, only been described within the last sort of 20 years, is that you're using, our body uses the precisely the same molecule to tell the rest of the cells that food is available and to tell the rest of the cells to grow. You know, makes sense, right? You only grow when food is available. When food is not available, you don't grow. Now, if you have an invasive species that is still somewhat like us, it will respond to those exact same messages. That is, anything that is going to tip your body towards growth, that is going to be pro-cancer. So anything that increases your nutrient sensors, like insulin, for example, is also going to be pro-cancer. And that's the link between the obesity and cancer. And this is a link that we didn't really know about until about 2003. So again, I did my medical school in the 90s, never talked about obesity and cancer, right? It wasn't until the sort of landmark study came out in 2003 where they made the link between obesity and cancer. Turns out it's a very, very strong link and very important given the increase in obesity over the last, you know, 40 years.
Excuse me. 100% agree. And it's not, and I don't want anybody to misunderstand, Dr. Fung is not saying that obesity causes cancer. What we're saying is that obesity and certain kinds of cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon, liver, ovarian, pancreatic, they're very closely associated with being obese. So, but that doesn't mean one causes the other. That means they're associated, from which you can draw the probably logical conclusion that they're both caused by, or at least the risk is increased of, if you have one, then you're probably doing the same things that are going to increase your risk of having the other. And so let's bring, I think this is very important to talk about. Again, guys, you're welcome to share this video. If you have anybody with a family history of cancer, has previously had cancer, or know anybody who's worried about it, please share this video with them. You can send it in an email, WhatsApp, however you want to do it. But this is important information that I think will make people feel more comfortable to know, oh, I can have an effect on my odds of developing cancer. We're not saying that what we're about to talk about, and this is not medical advice. We're both doctors, but we're not giving you medical advice. And these are just hypotheses that we're about to talk about. But I really want to ask Dr. Fung a few of these questions. And these questions make most doctors nervous, because if you ever say, as a medical professional, that there's any other option besides chemo, radiation therapy, and surgery for cancer, if you ever even pretend that you believe that there's anything else that might have an effect, you're immediately given some negative words. You're given some new titles that people love to call doctors when they think that they're not, you know, adhering to the party line. But let's talk about that. You mentioned insulin earlier, and there are specific foods that spike your insulin, and there are specific lifestyles of habits of eating that will keep your insulin level chronically high. Yes, and so having a chronically high insulin level is absolutely related to being obese and all of many, many other chronic health conditions. Insulin is a growth-like hormone. And so it makes perfect sense that it's going to increase your risk of developing a cell that's a nice citizen into an anarchist cancer cell if you keep your insulin levels chronically inappropriately high. So is it okay, Doc, if we talk about some dietary and lifestyle strategies that would most likely, hypothetically speaking, decrease your risk of developing cancer in the first place?
Yeah, and this is the thing, is that if insulin is a growth factor, now we know that that's true for sure, then you can say, well, if you are going to eat a diet full of refined grains and full of sugar, for example, then you're keeping your insulin levels high So your nutrient sensors are high, and the instructions that you are giving your body is to grow, right? Which is going to favor a disease of growth such as cancer, because cancer likes to grow. So we actually know that in Ecuador, there's a very rare syndrome called Lahren syndrome, where you get dwarfism, but they actually have, you know, no response to IGF-1, which is insulin-like growth factor. So they don't respond to the growth signaling of insulin, and they actually turn out to be almost completely immune to cancer. Well, you can draw conclusions from that. So if having no insulin basically makes you immune to cancer, well, then having super high insulin levels all the time, well, that's going to increase your risk. So you take a condition such as obesity, which we know is related to hyperinsulinemia. So people who are overweight, they have higher insulin levels. You're going to predict that you're going to have higher risk of those obesity-related cancers. And the WHO now classifies 13 different types of cancer as obesity-related. So now if you say, okay, well, we can hypothesize that insulin is the link, then you say, well, how are you going to change that? Well, eat a diet that's going to be lower in insulin. And that's pretty easy, because you take the foods that are going to raise your insulin the most, which is refined carbohydrates, which is sugar, and you simply don't eat as much of that. So eat natural foods, because if you look at natural versus processed food, there's a huge difference. You look at glycemic index, for instance, huge difference in the glycemic index of those two foods. The unprocessed stuff doesn't really have that much of an effect. The other thing, of course, that's really important is intermittent fasting, because if you are not eating, your insulin levels are going to drop. And therefore, if insulin is really that important, you're going to lower your risk of developing these diseases. At the same time, of course, you're going to lose weight, so therefore your obesity is coming down. So the hope is that if you change your diet, you'll lose weight, therefore you'll reduce your risk of obesity-related cancers, which seems a fairly reasonable hypothesis to me. Like, it doesn't seem outlandish. Yeah. And there's actually data to support some of that. So, for example, in breast cancer, there's some very small studies that suggest that women who fast 13 hours or more each night, like, you know, a nightly fasting period, versus those who eat all the time, the people who fast regularly have a lower risk of recurrence of breast cancer, for example. Now, these are small studies, but on the other hand, they make perfect sense. And these interventions don't cost you anything. Exactly. You know, it's not like people are out to get your money. It's people are trying to, you know, you can fast yourself right now, like tomorrow, and you don't have to pay anybody anything, right? It's one of these things that is just so powerful, like potentially life-changing if you do it regularly, because remember, this is a chronic disease, so you can't fast once and think that you're doing any good. You got to keep it down all the time. And the whole point is that if you do that regularly, then you're going to keep your insulin levels down, you're going to keep from gaining weight, you're going to prevent yourself from getting type 2 diabetes, which is another disease of too much insulin. We know you have, in that condition, you have too much insulin. And again, huge increased risk of cancer in type 2 diabetes. Yep. So it's like, okay, this all makes perfect sense.
Yeah,
and really yet there's a treatment that's like sitting in front of us, staring us in the face. Yeah. And here's why don't you use it?
Folks, Dr. Fung is not saying that insulin is bad. Insulin is good. You need insulin. It's good for you. What you don't want is chronic, inappropriately elevated levels of insulin or chronic repetitive insulin spikes that go on through the day. So if you're eating, as he famously says, three meals or three snacks in between, you're going to have multiple episodes of hyperinsulinemia over the course of each and every day of your life. And also, many of the foods that cause insulin spikes also cause chronic inappropriate inflammation in various parts of your body as well. And if you'll remember what Dr. Fung said earlier, it's not a lethal injury that leads to cancer. It's a chronic little minor injury that's just a chronic repetitive little injury that doesn't kill the cell, but it basically takes the shackles of society off it and allows it to run rampant and turn into cancer. And so anything that causes chronic inappropriate inflammation in your body has to increase your risk of cancer. It just has to. There's no way around that logic. And anything that chronically elevates your insulin levels above normal level multiple times a day. Any food that does that has to increase your risk of cancer. It's just simple physiological logic. You can't even really argue with it. But the problem becomes, Doc, is there's no you can't get a patent on intermittent fasting. And you can't get a patent on the ketogenic diet or the low-carb diet or the carnivore diet. So there's no money to be made. So the University of Toronto or the University of Tennessee, they're probably not interested in really studying this aggressively because there's no billion-dollar patent at the end of that research trial. There's no surgical procedure that's you're going to get to name after yourself if you come up with some new surgical procedure, right? Because fasting is free. It's the cheapest cleanse and the cheapest diet in the world. And then keto, ketovore, carnivore, whichever low-carb option you decide to make your way of eating, you can't get a patent on that. Maybe you can sell a few books based on it, but there's no billion-dollar payday at the end of that. So in your opinion, Dr. Fung, how do we get around that kind of economic cage that fasting and low-carb diets are kind of stuck in? Because the Harvard School of Public Health is never going to talk about this because there's no billion-dollar patent to be had from it. How do we get around that?
I think this is the problem, right? I mean, it is a huge problem because there's a massive financial conflict of interest in people developing these drugs. They want to see a $1 billion payday at the end of it because they're investing like billions of dollars to develop this. And so from a company standpoint, you can understand what the incentives are. But the problem is, and this is where the financial conflicts of interest come in, is that those same companies wind up paying to do, talks, they give talks, you know how it is. You get these fancy dinners that they take us to. They send you on trips to like Vienna and Paris to go to this conference where they're going to some expert. And, there's studies showing that the more highly placed university doctor, the more money they take from pharmaceuticals. So this is the big issue, is that it's not the companies. The companies are there to make money. They're very clear. They have no conflict of interest. They're there to make money. Yes. The problem is when you have doctors and academics and professors who take money from drug companies, now they are sort of like, you don't bite the hand that feeds you. So now all of a sudden you're pushing all these drugs, pushing bariatric surgery, when really you should be pushing fasting. Well, how many people are pushing fasting? Like, it's so crazy that you have like a couple of doctors, like 10, that are pushing fasting, and sort of, 990,000 other doctors who are pushing drugs, right? Yep. It's like, come on. Like, how is this even allowed? And it's due to the financial conflicts of interest. And what we should really say is like, look, if you're a doctor, you're in a privileged position. You cannot have a conflict of interest. You make your money by treating patients. You don't make your money by taking money from drug companies, right? That's, to me, it's a very clear solution that we have to demand that if you are a doctor at Harvard Medical School, you should not get any funding from any pharmaceutical or anybody. You get paid by Harvard. That's it. That's all you get.
Absolutely. Right? That's something that's absolutely got to change. That's got to change. And I think doctors have to start pushing back against that. A great analogy would be, what if I were the local chief of police and the biggest criminal in the city said, hey, Dr. Barry, Chief of Police Barry, I'm going to give you $100,000 grant so you can study crime in our city and you can come up with better ways to fight the crime in our city. So the mafia is going to pay me, the chief of police, $100,000 grant. They're just going to give it to me. No strings attached for me to research how I can lower crime in my city. Does anybody out there, do you see an immediate problem with that? You should, because there is a huge problem with that. But what a lot of people don't know, Dr. Fung and I are slapping people on Twitter routinely for this, but a billion-dollar drug manufacturing company can give a medical university or even a single doctor $100,000, $1 million, $10 million grant to study how to cure cancer, right? And that sounds very noble and very wonderful, but guess what? That big pharmaceutical corporation, they make products, and Dr. Fung's exactly right. it's not the fault of the corporations. It's the fault of the doctors and the PhD researchers who look the other way and say, well, I mean, we're going to be able to do a lot of good with this money that the mafia gave us. We're going to be able to fight crime in our city with that money. Even though it's coming from the literal kingpin of crime in our city, it's okay to take that money because I'm going to use that money to do so much damn good in our city against crime. That's just ignorant on its face.
Yeah.
And so in medicine, a lot of people don't know this, Doc. If you proclaim your conflict of interest, you still get to keep talking. And so you literally be speaking at a medical conference and say, now I am sponsored by Pfizer, by Merck, by Eli Lilly. And so there's my disclosures. Now I'm going to tell you what to think. Yeah, you can literally do that in a medical conference and no one bats an eye. They're like, oh, okay, he's paid off by a bunch of these companies, but he's still going to get to speak. Because what should happen is if you declare a conflict of interest, you should be escorted off the stage.
Absolutely.
You should be done at that point.
And this is the thing, is that we have so much evidence now that says the people who fund, you know, if you fund a researcher, it biases their opinion by a huge amount. Like, it's just human nature, right? Somebody gives you $1 million, you like that person. Like, doctors are humans too, but we have to recognize, and I think this is where the doctors are so behind everybody else, like the policemen and the judges and, you know, everybody. Nobody's allowed to take bribes. Except doctors. Like, I'm allowed, and I haven't done this in ages, but I did. I did like 10, 15 years ago before I recognized it was such a problem. I'd go out to this fancy dinner, and I'm not talking like, you know, a $20 dinner. Like, these drug companies take you to these meals that cost $150, $200, right? The nicest place in town. Now, you know it. And they'll send you to these conferences, and all they ask is that you listen to some guy. Well, the guy who's a big university guy, they've already paid off. They're paying him a couple $1,000s to speak to me. And I think, okay, I'm getting unbiased opinion, but it's not. It's obviously completely biased. And they know that because, of course, the drug reps know every prescription you write. And they basically want to see a return on their investment. And I don't fault them for that. I don't think there's anything wrong with them trying to make a buck. I think that the system of doctors, I mean, it really has to change, because otherwise you don't get these common sense, like, you know, you have, you're going to get anorexia. It's like, you think the 65-year-old man who weighs 400 pounds is going to get anorexia nervosa? Like, are you serious? Like, I get this all the time, right? It's like, what universe do you think we're in, where the 65-year-old man who weighs 400 pounds and has type 2 diabetes and is at super high risk of cancer and a heart attack, like, why am I worried about anorexia nervosa exactly? Because somebody's paid you off? I mean, that was the whole keto crotch thing, right? That didn't even exist. It was just a total made-up thing. And exactly. Of course, there's some money behind it, obviously, but it's the same thing, right? So here we have an effective intervention. You don't eat, your blood sugars come down. You don't need drugs, right? You lose weight. You know, maybe your blood pressure, you don't need your blood pressure medications. So all of this stuff is like almost beyond sort of any debate. If you don't eat, you'll lose weight. That's it. You can't not lose weight practically, right? So why is nobody talking about it? Because this is the biggest problem that we have today. I mean, maybe COVID is a bigger problem, but, you know, when that goes away, it's heart disease and cancer and diabetes and Alzheimer's disease and the rest of it. That is the most important medical issue that we face, and yet we have a solution that is free and obvious and applicable to anybody, like a little bit of, you know, medical intervention by a doctor, and hey, you can fast, right? I mean, obviously talk to your doctor first, but, you know, if you know, who's going to say that that doesn't work? Right? Who's going to say if you don't eat, you're not going to lose weight? Obviously, you will. So it's like, here we have this solution that just about nobody talked about. Like 5 years ago, 7 years ago, when I started talking about it, nobody was really talking about it. And then now that I've been talking a little bit about it, it's getting out there. But no, doctors are talking about it.
Yep.
About how you can reverse your type 2 diabetes, because we see it every single day. Every single day, somebody says, hey, you know what? I reversed my type 2 diabetes. I started fasting. I got off all my meds. It's done. I see people losing weight left and right. And it's like, well, now you're so much healthier. People got off medications and stuff. Why isn't it being taught? I talk to some medical students sometimes and they're like, oh my God, I didn't know any of this. Why am I not being taught? I'm like, I know, but it's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah. And I think one of the most powerful things that we can do as doctors, and this is to anybody else out there who's a healthcare provider in any way, if you're a nurse, dietitian, doctor, the most important thing you can do is start to help people right now by sharing this knowledge. Because like Dr. Fung just intimated, medical students, they're not hearing any of this from their professors. It's going to be at least 15 to 25 years before basically the truth that Dr. Fung and I know and we share with you every day, it's going to be 15 to 25 years before that truth, that inexpensive, easy to adopt truth is filtered into medical school education. That's just how the system works. The PhDs and MDs who teach in medical school are going to continue to talk about the sexy new pharmaceutical drug. They're going to continue to talk about the new whole grain plant-based veggie bar that just came out from some big food manufacturer, because that big food manufacturer sent them 3 cases of the veggie bar to sample. And so now they're going to talk about those things to their students. That's it. Doctors are people too. They are susceptible to all the bias and to all of the kind of machinations that make people say what they say or forget to mention what they should have mentioned. And people think that doctors are somehow different. They're not. They're just as susceptible to bribery, even no matter how subtle the bribery is. We're susceptible to that. And we may think we're not. I saw a comment go by that said, yeah, but a smart doc could sit there and eat that $150 steak and then walk away and still practice medicine in the way that they know to be appropriate. And that is true. But many, many doctors are swayed by the very academic looking doctor that the big pharmaceutical corporation has paid to speak at this. These doctors have long flowing white coats that look like Princess Diana's train. Their coat is so long that the average doctor's like, well, I just practice in podunk with my little family medicine or pediatric or internal medicine. You know, who am I? This guy must be right. I mean, I'm eating a $150 steak. How can you be wrong? That's the wrong logic. But many doctors fall prey to that. So, Doc, as we close this up, I first want to just thank you from the bottom of my heart for doing what you do and for sharing this information and not shutting up and not being bullied into shutting up about this, and for being a guest today. If you could just have 3 or 4 key takeaways, if you would just say, okay, it's my theory that the following things will greatly decrease your risk of developing cancer, or if you've had cancer in the past, will decrease your risk of developing a new cancer. What would you say the 3 or 4 easy, basic, simple steps, and this is not medical advice, people, still go see your doctor, but what would you give the takeaway messages?
I think that there's sort of 3, right? So 1, if you're overweight, we know your risk of cancer is much higher. So get back to a normal weight. And you don't have to do fasting. I mean, there's lots of different ways. And keto is a one way, and paleo is one way, and there's carnivore. But you can also do it with other ways too, right? So vegetarians and vegans. Like, you can lose weight in multiple different ways. 2 is, if you have type 2 diabetes, then you need to reverse that. Because again, we know that condition is going to put you at super high risk of heart disease and cancer. And once again, what's crazy is that this is a reversible disease. Type 2 diabetes, everybody knows, like you and I know, and so does everybody else, that if you lose weight, your type 2 diabetes will get better. And yet doctors are out there saying it's chronic and progressive. It's like, that's crap, because everybody knows it's reversible. So you need to reverse that. And again, there's multiple ways you can do that. You don't have to do anything specifically. And 3, it's do the intermittent fasting, because fasting is honestly like so advantageous from many, many different perspectives. Like, it's free and it's convenient and it's simple. And, you know, there's like very few rules in it. And you can apply it to any doctor and any diet you want to do. So there's so many advantages to doing it. It's the most powerful tool you have. So you need to use it, right, in whatever way you feel comfortable.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Fung, so much. It's been a great honor. Absolutely love this book. I've got a picture of it up on the screen now, guys. There's a link to the book. There's a link to all of Dr. Fung's books in the show notes up here on Facebook, down there on YouTube. And I'm not sure where it's at on Periscope. I'll have to look. This is my first time I've ever broadcast live on Periscope. But thank you so much. You guys are welcome to share this. Go check out Dr. Fung's website. I've got a link too in the show notes for that. It's been an absolute pleasure, Doc. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you. And I just want to mention too that I'm also uploading new YouTube videos. I'm starting to focus on that again. So I've got sort of new stuff coming out weekly, and I've just started some stuff on fasting. So if you're interested in it, there's a lot of great new videos on my channel on YouTube. So check it out. It's got fasting and calories, and eventually I'll have everything. So keep
an eye out for that. What's your YouTube channel, Doc? Because you got YouTube videos out there that aren't on your channel.
Yeah. So I have one. My channel is called Jason Fung. So just make sure that that's the one. It's got a blue check mark on it. There's another one called Dr. Jason Fung, but it's a sort of a scam channel. So just make sure you go to my channel so that you can see all the sort of original stuff that I'm putting out, and you don't get fooled into like buying some crazy diets or supplements or something like that.
I'll put a link to your real YouTube channel in the show notes as soon as we're finished. And again, I can't thank you enough, Doc. This has been amazing. I hope you guys enjoyed this. I'm going to be doing more and more of these live interviews with very important people like Dr. Fung in the near future. And so if you haven't already subscribed to my channel, do so. And then I'll put a link in the show notes to Dr. Fung's YouTube channel. You absolutely need to subscribe to his channel and click the bell so that every time he posts a new video, you get a notification and you watch it immediately, because that's how important his information is. Thanks so much, Dr. Fung. Thank you guys for watching. See you next time.
Thank you.